My daddy has lots of books, and he likes to read books. And he interviews authors at KAZI. You are now going to listen to KAZI Book Review with Hopeton Hay.
My guest today on KAZI Book Review is Richard Z. Santos. He is the author of Trust Me, and it is his debut novel. Richard Santos is a writer and high school teacher living in Austin. He has an MFA from Texas State University and has taught at Texas State, Georgetown University, and the University of the District of Columbia. Today's show is really based on three parts from Richard Z. Santos. The first part is his summary of the novel that we recorded to promote the fourth annual celebration of Diverse Literary Voices of Texas, Focus on Fiction, which was on June 13th. So he gives a real good summary of the novel. The second part of this interview is actually from the fourth annual celebration of Diverse Literary Voices, Focus on Fiction event on June the 13th. It was a Zoom event. We had three other authors. And so we will have Richard reading an excerpt from his novel and a follow-up question I asked him after reading from the novel. And then the last part of this interview actually comes from when I was doing a pre-interview with him. I was just trying to get to know him in preparation for the Focus on Fiction event of Diverse Literary Voices of Texas. And we just talked a lot about his love for Toni Morrison, my love for Toni Morrison. And we talked a lot about books in general and his career in writing. So stay tuned.
This is Richard Z. Santos. I'm the author of Trust Me. This is my debut novel. It's a story about drug dealing, power, corruption, and Santa Fe, New Mexico. Before the novel begins, a development group has bought some land from a Native American Pueblo in order to build Santa Fe's first modern airport. But when a skeleton is found on the construction site, everything grinds to a halt, and people are poised to lose a lot of money. The novel follows a few different characters. There's the millionaire landowner who's trying to build the airport. There's his wife who wants a way out of their marriage and is looking for some information to some of the darkness that's surrounding the construction project. There's her ex-husband who lives in Washington, D.C., but takes a job out in Santa Fe, clueless to what he's about to stumble into. There's also a local guy who loses his job on the construction site and is desperate to make some money so he can reconnect with his estranged son. I'm going to read a page or so from the second chapter. It's the first time this character is introduced. Hell of a week for Gabriel Luna. First, he was fired from a job he hated. Then he discovered his mean bastard of a father gave him bone cancer. Driving a dump truck on San Miguel Pueblo did not pay well, but it did pay. Gabe was helping to build Santa Fe's first major airport. And although the dust gave him headaches and he hated the hours and the heat, he occasionally felt something close to pride in the work. Then a bulldozer dug up a skeleton where there was not supposed to be a skeleton and the whole site went to sh**. A man with shiny shoes climbed onto the bed of a truck and, with shaking hands clasped in front of his mouth, sent everyone home. Gabe and the other laborers were given vague corporate assurances that the site would reopen after a swift investigation into the origin of the artifacts. He wasn't holding his breath. Holding his breath might be better, though, than letting the bone cancer tunnel through his body. The same cancer had worn his father down to nothing but pain and sweat. Gabe would not go out that way. The diagnosis came from Shaman Jeff, whom Gabe called Jefe. Wearing his customary blue Halliburton cap and smoking a cigarette, Jeff had said, "Yep, that's cancer, to the core. Can damn near see it dripping from your nose." Gabe imagined his dying old man spitting bone cancer cells like pollen spores, special delivery, aimed right at the son who was never there. Granted, no actual doctor had diagnosed him. Jefe's diagnosis came after poking a few lymph nodes and lighting a candle. But in 15 years, he had never steered Gabe wrong. The cancer was chewing on Gabe's bones, that was for sure. Now, a couple weeks after that 1-2 punch, Gabe pulled up in front of Jefe's trailer and killed his bike. Time for his second treatment.
Thank you, Richard, for reading that excerpt. I thought what was interesting about your book, which is about drug dealing, corruption, power and land rights, and Santa Fe, New Mexico. So you have three main narrators. So you read from Gabe, who's kind of down on his luck. He's working at this airport development site, and he actually finds the skeleton that moves the plot forward. We also have Charles O'Connor, who's a political operative down on his luck. and has moved from Washington, D.C. to Santa Fe because he is unhireable. And we have Olivia Branch. She is the wife of Cody Branch, the multimillionaire developer building the airport, who wants to divorce Cody. So we have three characters that are kind of in situations where they're really looking to get either make a comeback, in the case of Gabe, make enough money to show his ex-wife that he's responsible enough to spend more time with his son, or with Olivia, who just wants to get a better agreement than what she agreed to with her prenuptial agreement. So why don't you set the stage for our participants in the Zoom meeting here about that Santa Fe environment that you've created.
Yeah. Santa Fe is an interesting place. New Mexico is a very strange and interesting place. My mom's family is from there. I've spent a lot of time there. And when I started to put together the notes for what this novel would become, I knew I was setting myself a big task of trying to like wrap my arms around the complexity, centuries and centuries of history, really complex racial dynamics. I mean, it's a state where for hundreds and hundreds of years, people have been moving back and forth across it, usually just through it, taking what they need and leaving lots of like wreckage behind them. Everything from the Spanish conquistadors to the Americans doing the atomic bomb tests to oil today and so on. I think that I also wanted to write a book where a bunch of characters were in a series of bad situations and they kept making it worse for themselves and then had to pull themselves back out, you know, because like you said, it's kind of a book about people trying to build an airport. And it's kind of a book about like a dude who doesn't know what else to do with himself. So he tries to like sell some drugs that he shouldn't be selling. But really it's about the power dynamics that put these people in these situations to begin with. And as they start being pitted against each other, it's really none of their faults. It's the fault of this sort of like larger context that they find themselves in.
And Richard, you actually wrote your first book, as you said earlier, in part based on your experience working in politics.
Yeah, I took a political job in Santa Fe. I was there for a year. It's not real. This book isn't based on that experience, but I knew pretty early that I wanted to write about, I didn't want to write about campaigns, but I knew I wanted to like bring in some of that experience and some of that knowledge and some of that, like, I don't know, some of that ethos into something. And my problem was that I knew I wanted to hit these kind of thematic ideas and I knew I wanted to like explore these notions, but I didn't really have a sense of, you know, little things like characters and plot and story and if it's interesting. So I spent years and years just spinning my wheels and writing drafts that were like boring. I mean, writing drafts where not much really happened. Writing drafts where I would write about the forests of Santa Fe or this or that, but there wasn't really much of a plot. Despite all evidence to the contrary, I did feel like there was something there. I felt like I got it into a good spot. You know, God knows how many drafts later, six, seven years. Couldn't get an agent, got lots of like, this is interesting, this is good, but one thing I kept hearing is that people didn't quite know where to place it, which is a classic thing that writers hear, and which I kind of get too. I mean, it's kind of a political novel without politicians. It's kind of a thriller mystery, but not really. There's a skeleton at the beginning, but the identity of the skeleton doesn't really matter. Even when some people try to claim it's one thing, I think all the characters and the readers know that it's not who they claim it is. And you know, just for me, I eventually became very happy with, you know, giving up. I you know, heard from tons and tons of authors. It seems like more authors than not say, well, I've got that like desk drawer book and it'll stay in there. And I needed to write it to get through, you know, whatever. But it's not going to be the one that was out there. And then when Arte Publico won the National Book Critics Circle Lifetime Achievement Award, I was like, oh, let me check them out. You know, I'd known of them, but I didn't know they took uninterested submissions. So I sent it in, and a month later, they were like, let's do this. And now it's out there. Although the joke I make is, if you publish a book during quarantine when bookstores are closed, have you really published a book? It's more of an existential question that I don't have an answer to.
And that is Richard Z. Santos speaking at the 4th Annual Celebration of Diverse Literary Voices focused on fiction event I had on June the 13th. Next up is the pre-interview I did with Richard that I decided to turn into an interview for this show. We talked a lot about his career, how he got into writing, his decision to major in English and literature, and whether or not his parents thought it was a good idea. We talked a lot about our favorite writers, and here it is. With me is Richard Z. Santos. He's the author of a new novel, his very first novel, a crime fiction novel called Trust Me. So, Richard, I want to talk a little bit about your history in writing. I went out and did some research, found out, of course, that you are a huge fan of one of the greatest writers of all time, Toni Morrison. So I found a review you wrote of her novel Home and her use of the theme home on HuffPost back in 2012. So I want to start off with talking about, when did you first start reading Toni Morrison and how did you fall in love with her writing?
Yeah, she's the best, isn't she? It's so sad that
absolutely
she's gone. So I read The Bluest Eye in graduate school. I did it through college as an English major, and then in high school, no one had assigned me any of her work. But in grad school, we taught The Bluest Eye to the college freshmen, and was just amazed by it, gripped by how bold the narrative was, the structure of that book. Really experimental and really interesting. And from there, went on by myself to Beloved and Song of Solomon, which is absolutely, Song of Solomon is one of my favorites. When I was starting to write this book, I pulled out about 10 titles and put basically on the corner of my desk as books to kind of like just keep in mind that I thought might be present in my novel, maybe structurally, maybe thematically, maybe because of setting. And Song of Solomon was in there because of the wanted to stay grounded in notions of family. But then at Texas State, I was really lucky. I took
I want to jump in real quick to let the audience know that you got your master's in fine arts at Texas State University.
At Texas State, yeah. And while I was down there, I took a literature course with Dr. Elvin Holt, and it was just Toni Morrison. So I got to reread the ones I had read before, but also discover ones I had never encountered, like Jazz in Paradise. And it was amazing. Just one book every 3 weeks or so. Really, really, everyone in that class was just blown away, especially the creative writers.
So before you got introduced to Toni Morrison, growing up, high school, middle school or junior high, when did you first discover your love of reading?
Pretty much right away. I remember always reading. I remember always having books around. Whether it's, and I still just had a daughter, so we dug out some of my old picture books, basically, and we have those around. I don't actually remember the kind of transition books. Like, I remember reading little silly little books with lots of pictures, and I remember jumping to, like, Stephen King and Tom Clancy. So, and I don't have a grasp, I don't have a good memory of those in-between books, because I know they were there.
Yeah, well, let's talk about Stephen King and Tom Clancy, and I've actually read Stephen King and Tom Clancy. I actually, up to a point, I read all the way through. I think I stopped reading everything after The Stand or one of those other novels, Christine or something. And then since then, I've probably read another 5 or 6 novels.
They're still
And I read Tom Clancy for a little while, and then I decided that I wasn't really feeling Tom Clancy anymore. So talk a little bit about Stephen King. Are you still a huge fan of Stephen King?
I do still consider myself a huge fan, but like you, of his past probably 20 books. I bet I've read 4, maybe 5. I still get excited to see them out there, and I always pick them up and read like the back and the first couple of pages. But I don't really make time for them anymore. I think the last new book of his I read all the way through was Lisi's Story, which I think nobody read. That book's probably 15 years old. It's about like a writer's wife dealing with her husband's death or something like that. So, I mean, I think it's, you have to applaud the range of his imagination. And I keep feeling like I'm going to go back to some of those books at some point, but I also know that, like so many things that you enjoy in the past, I'm a little bit afraid they should stay in the past.
Well, there's one book we probably should go back to. And if you're thinking what I'm thinking, it's The Stand.
The Stand, sure. I've been, you know, I've noticed lots of people watching these movies right now, like Pandemic and Outbreak, and reading these books. And that's good for them. If that's going to make you feel better.
It's too heavy for you right now. You don't need it reinforced.
Yeah, no, I started reading Paul Tremblay's new book last night. It's comes out in June. It's called Survivor Song, and he's an amazing writer. He's a truly scary writer. And it's about like a plague. And the first chapter is horrifying. And I was like, yeah, I'm probably going to not finish the rest of this one.
Well, let me ask you a question. You brought up an interesting subject, which was called, you said he's an amazing writer. And I can recall some years ago, I read a book. I thought it was a really good story. I gave it to someone who was a literature geek, and they told me it was a horrible novel. And so I was thinking that, you know, and then there's the general public who didn't study literature, didn't study English. And I tend to think that we look at stories more and that writers look at the writing. And I know there's some mix of the two. I just wanted your comments on that, how you'll look at something, you'll look at the writing style and the writing technique. And I'm being a little presumptuous here, whereas I'll be looking at, I'm a huge fan of James Lee Burke. I love the interior stories of the characters. I love the way he addresses the social issues of the day. And I love the way he tells the story. But I have a degree in accounting, so I can't really comment with any level of sophistication about the writing other than saying, well, I think it's good. So why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think they all come together, and certainly in the best books, there's a real like unity of both of those things. I mean, you're talking about Toni Morrison. I mean, she has plots. Like Song of Solomon is a big story. There's guys who can fly. There's a mystery. There's a journey into the past. You know, you can reduce Beloved to a haunted house story, right? Like I think the great works have really active stories. I think I don't have a lot of patience for modern work where there's a lot of just kind of sitting around and reflecting on the state of how difficult life in the suburbs is. Every once in a while, there's something that
you don't like. Navel gazing novels, is that the right term?
Yeah, that's the right term.
Well, there is one author I actually do like who does that, probably. Oh, Tessa Moshfegh.
Yeah.
She's
great.
She's an amazing writer because for me, when I read her work, and I've interviewed her, I think I've interviewed her twice, actually, and I met her when she came to Austin on a book tour. She writes about stuff that we all know exists, but really think it's not something you discuss in polite company.
Mm-hmm. But yet still that the novel Eileen, it's like a stalker.
Oh yeah. Irene, you know, yes.
You know
she's got a new novel coming out.
I got the advanced copy. I haven't gotten into it yet. I think I just started it last night.
Yeah.
I should have started it last night instead of Paul's novel.
I'm gonna be reaching out to her publicist to get an advanced copy of it, or these days a lot of stuff now they're saying here's the Witch of Golden Neck Galley.
Yeah, it's not the same.
No. So let me ask you this. So where did you grow up?
San Antonio.
San Antonio, Texas. Okay. All through high school?
Yeah. Born there, all through high school. Went to college in Austin.
What'd you major in?
English and history.
English and history. Did your parents say to you, how are you going to make money?
A little bit. There's definitely a little bit of that. But, you know, my mom also knew that I wanted to study what I wanted to study, and she trusted that I would figure it out. And I still don't know if I've proved her right or not, but we'll know. Who knows?
So does teaching English have any impact on, or did it have any impact on the writing of your first novel?
You know, it slowed it down, I would say. Teaching is as time consuming as they say.
Hold on, let me add, I just showed the picture and this isn't being videotaped. So the book is Trust Me by Richard Z. Santos, but go ahead.
Yeah, I love teaching, and I think that one thing it has done for me is made me really value the breaks. You know, like summer break is no joke. It's a great thing. I had 2 weeks in December, a week in March, 3-day weekends here and there. It really forced me to use that time. I was like, this is my time.
You're working on your first novel, and you've written short stories, etc. Does that affect the teaching that you do in class?
I think as an English teacher, one of the things I always say from day one, and I say it in class, you know, darn near every day, I'm like, writing is hard. Writing is the hardest thing to do. You know, I tell my students that it's unnatural. There are very few things that animals do that we don't do, or that we do that animals don't do. You know, they eat, they hunt, they play, they live in communities, they can decorate themselves in various ways. They can use tools, some of them. They communicate, but they don't write because it's something just accessible seemingly to our brain and requires a real, you have to wrap your brain around communicating at a distance through a flat medium. I mean, there's a reason why human beings are around, what, 150,000 years before the first signs of writing came out, because it's hard. And I get a lot of high school students, most of them, that are just intimidated by it. You know, they see books, they see writers and movies, they know that there's this world out there, and they think it's not for them. And then they sit down, write a paper or something, and they struggle with it, and they think it's their fault. So I'm always quick to be like, look, this stuff is hard. I know. I do it all the time, whether it's my book or reviews or anything. So I know exactly how hard it is. And I think that helps them feel better about their own struggle. You know, they expect math to be hard, but they get down on themselves when they have trouble writing.
So we talked about Toni Morrison and the HuffPost piece you wrote several years ago, calling her the greatest living writer, maybe the greatest writer, I guess, of the 20th century, 21st century. Living writers today, your pantheon of living writers today, your go-to novelists.
Novelists. Interesting. I think Louise Erdrich has to be up there. She's amazing. She's amazingly prolific. And I think she's really underappreciated. She's probably has more than 20 novels out there. And so many of them are connected. And that's just the thing that really blows me away about her work. You know, a minor character in one novel will be the narrator, or the protagonist of the next novel. And then will be in the next one.
So you're giving us a hint of your upcoming novels? That the characters from this, Trust Me, will make it into these other novels?
I don't think that'll happen. Although, to be honest, I have so many previous drafts of this book that looks completely different that I could probably, like, fix some of those, and they would feel like they're like cousins.
How many previous drafts?
Just tons. I mean, I struggled and struggled and struggled. I probably threw away 200,000 other words. This final book's what, like 75,000 words. Complete drafts that just were just sitting on the page. Just the story never came together. Or I got started and would get, you know, 30,000 words into a draft, and I'd be like, this just isn't working. You know, I think my problem was I thought I knew the kind of book I wanted to write. Because my mom's family's from New Mexico, and I moved to Santa Fe while working in politics years ago, and like the protagonist in this book. And from that moment on, I was like, I got to write a book about this. And my problem was I kept trying to write that book instead of just writing a book. So I kept thinking, like, the Bandelier National Monument, the cliff dwellings outside of Santa Fe. That's amazing. It's beautiful. It's magical. I got to get the characters there somehow. So I would force them there. I'd be like, there's that ghost town between Albuquerque and Santa Fe. Let's have a scene go down there. And I was just jamming these pieces together. Oh, I got to talk about campaigns because I know about campaigns because I've been on campaigns. And I would just write pages and pages and pages and pages. And I...
You didn't have an outline at first? Did you have an outline, or was this more of a stream of consciousness, organic? Because I've heard both stories. A lot of the mystery writers, a fair number of the mystery writers I talk to outline, but the literary writers I tend to talk to tend to be more of a writing it as it's flowing.
I started with the setup of an East Coast Politico arriving in Santa Fe and quickly being swamped, which really pulling on my like noir and like mid-century crime novel like love, and I knew there would be danger, and I knew there'd be these, I had these notion of these like outside forces that would be coming in. I knew there'd be like a rich real estate guy who would be trouble. I knew someone from his past would show up. I knew there'd be some locals that are just kind of bumming around. I knew that the Pueblos up there would play a role. But as I went through all these drafts and just tossed out pages and showed them to people, and they told me to toss out those pages, I started outlining more and more and more and more. And so by the time I got to these last couple of drafts, I had timelines for each character. I had real, like, I was drawing arrows between things to make sure I knew what was happening. The whole book only takes place in about 8 days. So I had to really like make sure that made sense chronologically. So I don't think it's a coincidence that the book came together only after I really, really understood what the story would be and did some precise outlining. So I guess somehow I did both. But that's also part of why it took me 6 years or so to write this.
6 years. So we talked about Louise Erdrich, and I haven't read her novels in many, many years, as I recall, and I think her novels tend to focus, really bring light to people on the fringes of society, people from the poor communities, poor neighborhoods, because it might be 20, 25 years since I read one of her books. Is that about right?
Yeah. In a lot of the Native American,
yes.
Who else?
Living Writers, yes.
I'm looking over at my bookshelf. Tim O'Brien was one of my professors at Texas State, and we became friends there.
I know Louise Erdrich. So Tim O'Brien, it's a writer I'm not familiar with.
He wrote The Things They Carried, and Going After Cacciato, which won the National Book Award. All of his novels are in some way about Vietnam. He was in Vietnam. The Things They Carry is a masterpiece, and really has become required reading. It's taught in more high schools than not at this point.
Thank you for this unintended official interview for KZI Book Review.
Thank you.
And that was Richard Z. Santos, author of Trust Me. It is his debut novel. Thanks for listening to this podcast edition of KAZI Book Review. Be sure to like my Facebook page entitled KAZI Book Review, and my Twitter handle is @KAZI Books, and my Instagram handle is KAZI_book_review. Have a great day.